From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, where we broadcast some favorite conversations, Kari Lizar-White discusses his debut novel, Passage. Comedian Paula Poundstone talks about her latest book, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. And critically acclaimed musician Sampha reveals the inspiration behind his album, Process. But first, recent studies have revealed that while higher education can indeed help students climb the economic ladder, colleges and universities are catering more to wealthy students and as a result are reducing the number of low-income students they serve. One of those reports is called Moving On Up, with a question mark. Stephen Bird is a senior policy analyst with the think tank New America and edited the report. He joins us now to tell us more. Stephen, good to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me more.
So basically, we wrote about a study that shows that four-year colleges, both public and private, have been abandoning their commitment to low-income students. Basically, there's this fierce competition going on in terms of colleges trying to recruit the students they desire the most, who tend to be the best and brightest students and the wealthiest students. And they're going after the best and brightest because they want to rise up the ranks of the college rankings and become more prestigious. But they're also going for the wealthiest to get more revenue. And colleges are actually using their own financial aid dollars to try to get these students, most of whom could go to college without any help. So as a result, there are fewer seats and less aid available for low-income students and working-class students. And we really have a two-tiered system where the richest students get to go to the best schools and low-income students are primarily going to community colleges and to for-profit colleges, many of which have been shown to be predatory.
Yeah. Have these institutions that are engaging this kind of activity, have they been called on the carpet on this yet?
Well, we've been trying to call them on the carpet. What's interesting, though, is we present these studies and there's a lot of talk about it, but on the actual campuses, usually it hasn't really totally seeped over to the campus. Colleges are praised for being more exclusive, and for getting students with better SAT scores, better grades. I mean, every year I get all of these letters from schools saying, look, we have the best class we've ever had. We have better SAT scores this year, better grades. And I'm always like, well, I mean, last year you said it was great. Why do you have to be better than last year? Why don't you just stay the same?
Yeah.
So that's really where we're headed. And all of the incentives, unfortunately, point to getting wealthier students rather than poorer ones.
Yeah. See, there's a part of me that wants to believe, Stephen, that universities have always wanted to have a smart class of students coming in.
Right.
Students certainly capable of doing the work.
Yeah.
So they don't want dummies.
Right.
To come. That's why we take SAT tests. Biased though may be, they want smart students. Number one.
Yeah.
So I'm not surprised by that. I'm also not surprised that institutions want students whose parents and students themselves who can eventually become givers. The Harvard endowment didn't just magically get to be where it is, or the Princeton or Yale endowment. So my point is that this strategy can't be a new strategy. What's making it so acute now? What's making it so much worse now?
Well, I mean, basically, you're right in a lot of ways. I mean, in a lot of ways.
They chase smart students.
They have always chased smart
students. And they
chase
money.
And there really isn't anything wrong with trying to get smart students. But there are plenty of academically well-qualified students who come from lower-income families. Mm-hmm. Going back to the 60s, this country made kind of a deal back to the Lyndon Johnson era that we would help low-income students get into the colleges in this country. And for a long time, colleges actually really helped. They were directing their financial aid to meeting the financial need of the students they were enrolling. And we saw major, major gains, particularly at public colleges and universities. But what's changed is that first of all, there are these ranking systems like U.S. News.
Sure,
so
sure.
Everyone wants to be on the top of the U.S. News rankings. And the criteria that they use tend to be things about being more exclusive, getting higher SAT scores, even like being wealthier, all gives them points. And then the other thing that's really changed is states have been divesting from their higher education systems.
Sure.
And this is really the tragedy, because when it comes to the way that the federal government gives money, there's no requirement for states to do their part or for institutions to do their part. So they've been redirecting their money to try to get the best classes they can buy. And one of the other big problems with that is that, like, basically every college wants to be Harvard, mm-hmm. and even the public colleges. And so we're all following the same model, which is not really the best use of resources.
So I'm not suggesting that we should not be holding accountable these institutions sure. who are engaging in this preposterous activity,
yeah.
To my mind. But what you said to me now suggests that we ought to be chin-checking U.S. News. If they're the ones who are setting the pace,
yep.
if they're the ones who are laying out the criteria, if they're the ones who have the list that everybody wants to be on, and the list is weighted in the way that you've just described, why are we going after U.S. News?
Well, we should be going after U.S. News, but it's very hard to go after publications. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure how you would do it. The funny thing is, you'll always hear, you know, college leaders saying, oh, we don't really care about U.S. News. But when you actually see some of the lobbying that goes yeah. on, and there's sometimes it's even written into the college president's contracts. You yeah. know, you must rise up the rankings to get, you know, better
but,
pay.
But how does, maybe this question hasn't been
yeah.
asked. Maybe this question hasn't been asked. But how does U.S. News justify the way it does its rankings when it knows that
right.
the end result is what we're talking about now, that poor students,
yep.
qualified poor students, are going to be pushed to the side, to the margins?
Well, you know, I don't think that U.S. News sees itself as having a social mission. I think that it sees itself as helping consumers.
Yeah.
And the types of consumers who mostly read U.S. News are upper middle income and wealthier students. So it sort of caters to what those kind of, you know, families would want and what they're looking for.
So what's happening, I'm not naive in asking this, but so what happens to these students of color, students who are not so wealthy but are qualified to go to these institutions academically otherwise? If the money is being dried up and, you know, held away from them, what's happening to them?
Well, I don't want to make it a completely bleak picture,
sure.
because there are low-income students who do go to Harvard. There are low-income students who get into, great public institutions. And what's interesting about the latest data that came out, there's a group called the Equality of Opportunity Project, and they mm-hmm. came out with a bunch of data about who's going to school and who provides social mobility. And you do see that when a low-income student goes to college and they're given that opportunity, they actually do as well mm-hmm. as higher-income ones. And so there's this kind of myth that low-income students can't handle, you know, academically rigorous schools. Mm-hmm. And this data that the Equality of Opportunity Project came out with shows that that's not true. But unfortunately, what we do see is that, just like in K-12, low-income students and minority students, in large part, end up at the schools with the least resources. And so you do see it at, you know, going to community colleges. And there's nothing wrong with a good community college. It's just that they tend to have a much harder time graduating from those schools. Those schools don't have as many resources to provide support services. And and then the worst part is for-profit colleges, mm-hmm. because we have seen waves of scandals with for-profit colleges luring students in and not providing the education that they promise. And then those students end up worse off than before they enrolled, with huge debt and not enough training to get careers to pay it off.
I'm not sure if you know the answer to this question.
Yeah.
Let me ask anyway, though, and that is whether or not diversity and inclusion counts for anything on the U.S. News rankings. Do you know the answer to that question?
I don't think that diversity does. I mean, I think that they've, around the edges, tried to address some of these concerns, mm-hmm. but I don't think fundamentally they do at all.
Yeah.
So. But I wouldn't just put it on U.S. News. I would also make sure we really look at states.
Sure.
And we say, you know, states have just been taking money away. And in part, that's because they can always put it on the student to, mm-hmm. you know, by raising tuition.
Sure.
But now, if you want to go to a public university in this country, and I've got two kids, so I'm worried, they're getting to be like the private colleges used to be. So they're very, very expensive. And what we saw was that over a 15-year period, by looking at this data that project mm-hmm. had produced, that two-thirds of public universities had reduced their share of low-income students, and two-thirds, some of it, you know, the same schools, had increased their share of wealthy students over this 15-year period. And we even saw that more than half increase the share of wealthy students at the direct expense of low-income students.
So what are families of low-income students to do?
Well, I mean, it's a great question. I mean, you never want to discourage people from going to the best schools that they can. I think what we really need to ask, though, is what are policymakers going to do? Yeah. We need the federal government to step in, because the colleges are not going to be able to change their ways themselves. We're not going to see U.S. News fold. What we've proposed is a grand federal and state partnership, where the federal government provides money that the states then, provide their own money to, or they match it, and then it goes to the institutions. And what we really need you've been seeing this with sort of the free college movement. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that that's exactly what we need, but we need something that is, we need a really big change.
Yeah. Every time I ask a question on this show, in this era, uh-huh. And the answer is, we need government to step up.
Yeah.
I want to just...
Oh, I know. It's not a good time.
I feel like Fred Sanford, man. It's like, in this moment,
right.
We know that's not going to happen.
Right.
And it's a sad reality, but I take your point. Good to have you on.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for sharing the research.
All right. Take care.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Kari Lazar-White is best known for his work as a social justice advocate. He co-founded the Brotherhood Sister Soul, a nationally renowned youth development and educational organization. He's also an attorney and a writer. His debut novel is called Passage. It's set in New York and centers around a young man called Warrior and his struggle to navigate and confront the forces that surround him. Kari, good to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Tess.
I was fascinated by the fact that you called this kid Warrior. Tell me why.
You know, I think it's so important when you're telling the stories of young black men, when they're telling their own stories, that they're able to put their own narrative front and center. This is a novel that's about the internal psyche of a young man. And what he loves about the meaning of his name is that it tells every single person he comes in contact with who he is and what he represents. And he feels he's at struggle for his very survival, to survive the conditions he's facing. Even though he's from a family of great love, his mother and his father provide so much support, but still the moment he leaves the doors, he's faced with the socioeconomic conditions that so many young people face, and he feels like he has to be a warrior to navigate that. And it's the tension between being strong and tough and wearing the mask, but also being sensitive and loving towards his family, and that runs through the novel.
You chose to give him a mother and a father. Why?
I think it's absolutely critical that we tell more stories about the wholeness and the power and the beauty of the black family. Obviously, it is a truth that so many of our young people grow up without a father in their life, but so many grow up with a father in their life. And so his parents are separated, but they have deep love for their son. And his father lives in Brooklyn and his mother lives in Harlem. And I wanted to show that deep love between a black man and his son. That's intimate, that's affectionate, that's loving, that's supportive. I think it's a story that needs to be told more often. And if we look at our history in this country, the reason that children have been able to survive over so many years of slavery and segregation and the continuing issues is because at times of the strength of the black family. And so often instead it's painted in a negative light. Mm-hmm. And that conversation needs to be had, but we also have to have a conversation about the strength of the family.
We all have our critics. So for those who would say that the drama that Warrior endures is a stereotypical story of what black boys in America deal with. So for those who would say it's on the one hand stereotypical, how do you respond to those? And the folk on the other hand who would say mother and father both in the house, that's aspirational. How do you respond to those critics?
Well, for those who say that it's stereotypical, I would say they don't live in those communities. Mm-hmm. And it's not their reality. The truth is that when we talk about violence in urban areas, whether it's Los Angeles or Houston or New York, or whether we talk about it in the rural areas as well, mm-hmm. It's not just about the violent act. It's about growing up around the ambient feeling of violence, the feeling that violence is right around the corner, that it can happen at any moment. And that's what I portray in the novel. This is not a novel that's filled with violent acts. It's the fear of violence. Mm-hmm. What does that do to the psyche of a young man? How traumatic is that for so many of our children that we allow them to grow up in those conditions? So I don't think it's stereotypical at all. He's based in great love and great support, who he is as a black young man in terms of his history and his culture and his people, but he's also confronted with the very, very real specter of violence. And again, I think the fact that he has a mother and father in his home, they're separated. His father lives in Brooklyn, his mother in Harlem. But the fact that children grow up with powerful male influences in their life and powerful female is certainly true. That is the other side of the coin. As rampant as a lack of fathers are in our community, we also know that there are millions of black men doing what they're supposed to do in our community as well.
How do you respond to that critique? I know I hear it all the time. I know you hear it all the time in the work that you do, which is this notion that oftentimes comes from the right, that the problem of black America is a problem of parenting, and that if we had more men in the families, in the homes, we wouldn't have half the problems that we deal with. How do you respond to the folk who say that that is primarily our problem, that we lack black men in homes?
Well, that's a big question. Yeah. I think there are a few different answers to it. I mean, the first is that we have a problem with manhood in our country. We have a problem with masculinity in our country. The majority of violence in this country is committed by white men, both murder and rape. And while black men are disproportionately represented in a lot of these statistics, violence is still perpetrated by men of all colors. We have all these mass shootings, and people often talk about that's about either mental health or that's about guns. One thing that's not talked about is masculinity and manhood. The women who are mentally ill are not doing mass shootings, it's men who are doing it. So do I think that there is a crisis of manhood in this country? Yes. Is that reflected in the black community? Absolutely. And do we need to talk about it? Without question. But the idea that that is the root of the problem in a country where 13 generations were born into slavery, 4 generations were born into segregation, and we have 2 generations born legally free, when we still have the kind of systemic oppression and racism that we know exists in this country, and to say the reason for the difficulties in terms of socioeconomic conditions for our children is because of black men, is taking the responsibility from where it should be put and putting it on the victim of the reality.
Right. So the work that you do every day is real work.
Definitely.
In the real world.
Definitely.
The conditions that Warrior has to navigate in this novel are real conditions that real Negroes have to deal with every day. Mm-hmm. And yet you chose to tell this story through a novel. Why a novel?
You know, Taz, I think art at its best, you know, inspires people. It's a journey that allows people into another person's experience. That I can read a novel that's about a white boy in a rural community, and it's J.D. Salinger's story of Holden Caulfield, and that stays with me. I can read Maxine Han Kingston's beautiful novel of a Chinese-American girl coming of age, and that inspires me. So I think part of the power of art is to allow others into the story and for them to understand things that sometimes statistics and policy and law doesn't allow people to be able to do, even though I often talk in that language as well.
Yeah.
But then this is also a novel that's written for young people facing these conditions. This is not a young adult novel. I hope people of all ages read it. But what I want is for especially young men in their teens and in their 20s to see their story here. And I think that there's a way to reach people by showing their story in this novel. I have a good friend, young man in his 30s. He said to me it was the first time he saw his face on the cover of a book.
Yeah.
Just the optics of this is my story, how powerful that is. And I think the last piece is that when you start talking about the power of art to transform, it's an idea. It's storytelling. Mm-hmm. And there's a way to tell a story in a novel that is not really possible when you're writing a political essay.
I'll come back to these black boys in just a second. Let me start with the good white folk first. Tell me why it is that you think that they will read a book and get a reality from a fiction text when many of them don't seem to get it when it's in their face, live and in living color on the network news every night.
I think that, you know, this is a country that only exists because of the objectification, the enslavement, and the continual persecution of black and brown bodies. That's what the country is built on, and we know that, and we know that so well. That's only been allowed to happen because of white folks who have been aggressively against black and brown people allowing it to continue, and also theoretically white people of good faith who have not stood up enough. And so we live in a time right now where this country has elected a person who articulates anti-woman litigation, issues, who talks about black and brown people and Muslim people in the most horrific way. None of that was enough, right? None of that was enough to stand in his face. That wasn't just those who were the known to be racist. Those were people's neighbors. Those were people's friends, right? So this isn't gonna speak to all of the, quote, good white folks who aren't getting it on the news and also won't get it through this novel. What I do think is it will speak to those who are our allies, the people who truly want a more humane world, who reject the kind of country we're living in now, this inhumane institution that we are living under. And I think it will speak to them. I hope it will.
Yeah. What I'm about to say now, you know well, given the work that you do, Kyrie. But I've been honored and I think blessed to do a number of primetime documentaries for PBS over the years about the plight and condition, the suffering, quite frankly, of young black boys. Mm-hmm. One of the things I learned many years ago, that again, you know full well, is if black boys don't develop a love of reading by the third grade, they're doomed. Mm-hmm. And so many of them, I discovered in the research, don't develop a love of reading by the third grade because they don't see themselves in the narrative. They don't see themselves as characters. That's the point you raised a moment ago about these young black boys who've never seen themselves on the cover of a book. I wonder whether or not you think that some of the issues that you have to navigate every day through the work you do with black boys would not exist if black boys, in fact, developed a love of reading earlier on.
You know, I think that the educational realities and outcomes that our children face is certainly a part of the crisis that we're facing. Mm-hmm. This idea that somehow doing well in school is being white is a very new phenomenon, as we know well. There was nothing blacker than doing well in school. Right. Our universities were birthed out of this. Teachers could move throughout the South and have homes to stay in because they were revered. And so I think part of it is not about having to find a new answer, but trying to find some of the solutions that were already there. The emphasis in our community on education, the desire to ensure that all of our children get the right education. That's done in two different ways. It's done by the direct service kind of work that I do at Brotherhood Sister Soul, that we do in our schools, helping the small number of young people to love learning, to love to read, to see in themselves aspirational goals of who they can become as men and as women. But it's also about changing the policies that create those conditions. I mean, the situation of education that we have across this country is abhorrent, that we allow children to attend schools where even if they do what they're supposed to be doing, theoretically, they're graduating with an eighth grade level education in urban systems all across the country, means we're selling those kids a false bill of goods. It means we're telling even the children who push through, you will not be allowed to compete in our society. And so I think education's key, but so's math and science and coding and all aspects of development of young people. I also think the arts are very important. I think ensuring that young people have a space to tell their story, to be able to deal with the trauma and the pain that they face in their life, often arts is an outlet for that. And that we see the arts ripped out of so many of our schools across the country means that that opportunity's not there. So I think we have to return to a much more holistic approach to the education of our young people, which so many of our schools don't focus on, even the ones that theoretically get the good test scores, that theoretically provide an education to prepare children. Are we preparing them to be ethical and moral people in an inhumane world and to try to change that world, or are we just preparing them for a test? And so we have to really look at the holistic development of young people, which is what I think is key. And that goes back to the earlier part of our conversation about what kind of citizens are we creating, right? This isn't a black and brown issue. If we're not dealing with moral issues of humanity, then we are not ensuring that we have more good white folks, more progressive white folks who will work with us hand in hand to change issues, more progressive Asian folks and Latino folks and black folks. This is a national issue we're dealing with. It's why we elected a president like Trump. It's why we have so many mass shootings all around the country. This divorcing from a more ethical and moral way to live our lives. And I don't think we're teaching that in schools because people are afraid to teach those issues. They're afraid to confront what undergirds that. You know?
I appreciate your work and your witness, and I thank you for the text. It's a novel. It's called Passage by Kyrie Lazar White. Thank you, brother.
Thank you.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Comedian Paula Poundstone was determined to find the secret to everlasting happiness and tried a series of experiments in that quest. She wrote about her findings in her latest book called The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. Paula Poundstone, good to have you on this program.
Thanks so much for having
me. It's good to see you again. Why a self-proclaimed Doubting Thomas?
I'll tell you, my book is a series of experiments, as you say, doing things that I or other people thought would make me happy. And every chapter is written as an experiment with the hypothesis and the conditions and the variables and hopefully the funniest field notes ever written. But the question for me wasn't whether I would enjoy doing something. The question was, what could I do that would give me, a little lasting mm-hmm. something? You know what I mean? Like when I finished doing it, I would have an umbrella, so to speak, for the inevitable rains of one's daily life. So the analysis of each chapter is the story of raising a house full of kids and animals and being a stand-up comic for a living, which I am, and just being stuck being me 24 hours a day. And I tried many things, and I think I came to discover one thing, which is there's a difference between happiness and enjoying something. Mm-hmm. You know, if I were to go on a Ferris wheel with my son, for example, I'm sure that I would enjoy it because I like Ferris wheels, mm-hmm. but I can guarantee you that by the time I got down, we'd already been in an argument.
Yeah.
You know, it's that would be something that I enjoyed, which is not the same as something that gives you lasting happiness.
And what did you discover, or have you discovered what happiness is for you?
Well, I think sadly it's more biochemical than it is romantic.
Uh-huh.
I think it has to do, and I wish this wasn't true, but I think it has to do with getting exercise and human interaction, by the way, uh-huh. very important, which I think we skip over a lot nowadays because of everybody
sure.
staring at their flat thing.
Yeah.
Which steals words like friends and connected, but in fact, electronics is to happiness and relationships what Doritos are to nutrition.
Yeah, yeah.
It is not good for you.
Did you figure out the secret to, how might I put this, sustained happiness rather than just periodic happiness?
I'm not sure there is such a thing.
Okay.
As really long. I mean, I think it's sprinkled in. I think it's yeah. an ingredient. I think, as I say in the book, if for me happiness can be the backbeat to the score of my life, I'm good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the other emotions have a place to play. You know,
yeah.
In the very first chapter, the Get Fit mm-hmm. Get Fit experiment. During that experiment, my dog died and one of my best friends died. And I firmly believe that had I been doing anything else other than working out, grueling workouts, not every day, by the way, yeah. but, you know, 3-4 times a week, I think I probably would have been sort of towed under by those
yeah.
sad things. But instead, it's not that I wasn't sad,
yeah.
but it, you know what I mean? It didn't overpower me.
As I read the book, it seems to me that after all the various
I love it that you read the book.
Well,
that makes me so happy.
Yeah, that's our job around here.
Yeah. But do you read fast?
No, I'm not a fast reader.
I just said to a friend of mine on the yeah. phone today, I go, I'm 57. I got maybe 3 more books to
yeah.
read.
Yeah.
You know, so I've got to choose very carefully. I'm yeah. auditioning authors yeah. right now.
As I go through the text, it seems to me that after all the experiments that you tried, and you correct me if I'm wrong here, that what you ultimately came to in terms of a conclusion was that there's some pretty basic things in life that bring us happiness.
Yeah, I think that's true.
I mean, you can try. My point is, you can try a lot of different things, but there's some
yeah.
pretty basic things that are pretty reliable.
And by the way, it's the stuff we were always told.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it really is like good. I don't do an experiment with having good sleep hygiene, as they call it, where you go to bed at a regular hour mm-hmm. and get up at a regular hour. I don't do an experiment in that. But what I do in one of them, the Get Wired experiment, mm-hmm. It took me 7 years to write the book for a variety of reasons. But I came to computers later than a lot of people did. But it was still several years ago when we had the big kind in my house, uh-huh. but I didn't know how to use it. My kids used it and my assistant used it. I went out, I decided, everybody kept telling me, you know, if you used a computer, everything's be so much better mm-hmm. somehow. So I went out and bought a laptop, because that you can bring door to door and mm-hmm. beg for help. Whereas
the mainframe,
right, the big kind, you got to lure
yeah,
someone
yeah, yeah.
into your house. And let's face it,
right.
Jeffrey Dahmer ruined that for everyone.
Yeah.
So so I bought the laptop thing. And what's interesting about the Get Wired mm-hmm. chapter is that because I started out a blank slate in terms of electronics, you actually see my steady decline into you know, the addiction of compulsion of staring at your flat thing,
mm-hmm.
whether it's a smartphone or a computer. And it is addictive. There's no question in my mind.
Do you regret having tried that experiment?
No, I don't. Yeah. I don't. I mean, it's not that I mind every aspect of it, but I definitely, my son, and it's a story that I tell in the course of the book, my son suffers from very severe electronics addiction. He seems to be doing well now, actually, I think, but it was years and years of, I put him in front of a computer when he was three because I didn't know any better.
Yeah.
And it's terrible for the developing brain.
What's your advice to parents about that?
None, zero. Yeah. That's my advice. We got to get them out of our schools. I, you know, fine, in high school, you want to have a tech class? Great. It's behind a door, right? We learned to type. We didn't carry the typewriter around all day. Mm-hmm. You put it in a classroom, and they have a class for it.
It was a little heavier, though. Yeah.
Well, there were some, right.
There were some constraints.
Yeah, there were some constraints. Yeah, but, you know, kids need... And by the way, it's one of the things in the book. People need to make eye contact. People need to shake hands. People need to give hugs. People need to put the occasional hand on the shoulder. These are very important. I was in New York, and I was struck by, as I was walking down these, you know, wonderfully crowded streets, streets crowded with people, right, that live there, work there, or are vacationing there. No exaggeration, 90% of them were either staring at their flat thing or they had a headset in. So here they've gone to the trouble of moving or visiting this place whose one of their virtues is it's full of people, and they're doing their very best to avoid those people. And that relationship with strangers is so important to us. We end up feeling isolated. I think we should live every day like the opening scene of Beauty and the Beast. You know, bonjour, bonjour. That's how we're supposed to be.
When I got this book, when it came across my desk, one of the first things I thought, other than how much I love the funny type.
You shoved your volume of Shakespeare away, exactly. And began reading this.
Started reading this, I love the funny title, but I was struck by your phrase, the search for human happiness, and it made me wonder whether or not you think other creatures find happiness. You know where I'm going with this, right?
No.
Do other creatures find happiness more easily than we do?
Well, we are really lucky that we have. I mean, I'm the luckiest performer in the world because I get to go on stage and say things that I'm, you know, that I think might be funny in front of a group of people who've come out to laugh for the night. And particularly now, where I feel that the entire world is in the midst of a mental health crisis, it is an absolute joyful job to be a part of this thing that's really good for people, which is laughing as a group. I think raccoons have it. I can't swear to it. But I'm telling you, I've seen raccoons, like, with one another, and they looked to me like they were amusing each other.
I
suspect that, you know, primates, but I don't know. Cats, not so much.
See, the fact that you say raccoons kind of gives me the chills because...
Why?
I'll tell you why. Funny story, but not so funny to me. So I literally just had all the fences around my house completely redone. Because there was a family of raccoons that were making their way under my fences and just having a field day in my backyard.
What were they doing?
Swimming in my pool, in my jacuzzi, laying on my lounge chairs. They just completely took over the backyard. And every night, about 3 a.m, they would just be out there having a field day. I had nothing against the raccoons, but I just kind of got tired of the raccoons then, taking over my backyard.
Then I am absolutely sure of my earlier premise.
They were very happy in my jacuzzi every night.
Raccoons do seek happiness, and apparently they find
in
it
in my backyard.
In Travis Smiley's backyard.
Yeah, well,
we fixed that.
We fixed that problem.
Were you serving, like, little umbrella drinks? Because that's part of your mistake. I mean, we had raccoons in my mulch pile, which is the closest I can come to having a pool and a jacuzzi. And a couple summers ago, we were having just a blazing hot summer. And one night, I see my cats, like, staring out the window at something, and I realize there's raccoons in the mulch pile. So I go out, and I take my son's super soaker gun. And I shoot water at these raccoons, and they come out. It's like a clown car. It was one after the other after the other. And the next night, they're out there again. And this time I go out with water balloons, and I pelt them with water balloons. You know, same thing. Now there's even more. Now the first night there were 7. Now there's like 10. And I realize it's roasting hot, and I'm throwing water at them. I think they went back to their friends. They go, you know, tomorrow night she's going to have a slip and slide. Just every night with the water games, me and the raccoons.
You gave exactly what they wanted. Here's my exit question. I was moved, all jokes aside, even though he's a very funny guy, I was moved when I saw your dedication in this book.
Oh, thank you. Robin Williams, was, you know, Robin was a mentor to lots of comics. Yeah. That frenetic excitement and energy that he had. He was the Tasmanian devil of stand-up comedy. And and people went out to clubs because they thought they might see Robin. And they saw the rest of us, and they liked that, too.
Yeah.
But he was the draw.
I tried to interview him one time, and I just gave up.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
There is no interview. There was no interview in Robin Williams. It's like, well, okay, dude, take over.
He had a little of the raccoon in him.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, you know, in earlier years, you may have found him floating in your pool in your jacuzzi if you didn't have the right fencing.
On that note, the book is called The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness by Paula Poundstone, endorsed by every funny comedian living these days. A lot of great endorsements on there.
I got Carl Reiner.
You got Carl Reiner. You got Dick Van Dyke.
You got Dick Van Dyke.
You got Dick Cavett. You got, oh, my God. And you got Lily Tomlin.
And I got Lily Tomlin.
I love it. Yeah. Good to have you on, Paula.
Thank you so much. It was great being here.
My pleasure. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Sampha is a British singer, songwriter, and producer with roots in Sierra Leone. He's best known to his fans for his collaborations with the likes of Drake, Kanye West, Solange, and many others. His critically acclaimed debut album is called Process. He joins us in the studio now to talk about it. Sampha, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Can I go right to this project? When I pulled, I love liner notes. Okay. I'm a fan of them. I pulled this thing out, and before I could get to the notes, I saw this photo of you and your precious mother.
Yes.
And you dedicate the project to your mother. Tell me about your mama.
My mom, her name's Binti Sisse. She's like a really, she's someone who we kind of have a very similar nature.
Mm-hmm.
I'm quite quiet, and she was quite quiet, reserved woman, but very sort of elegant and thoughtful, really like a caring woman. Yeah, she was like, I was lucky to have her as a mother.
Did your mother have, your mother and your father for that matter, I want to talk about both of them.
Yep.
Did your parents have any influence on your music?
Yeah, they did. I mean, my dad bought a piano
for
the house when I was like 3 years old. And that obviously had a huge effect on my on my life. And my dad used to buy lots of music, like coming home from work, he would sort of like pick up, I don't know, anything from like HMV, which is like a music store in the UK, from like the Spice Girls to Pavarotti's, like African music. So they were very encouraging as well, because they could see I had like a penchant for like music, you know. So yeah, they did have an influence.
With so much eclectic sound around you, when your father's bringing home so many different types and genres of music, how did you find yourself in that? How did you find your own musical way when you're being exposed to so much stuff?
I just naturally gravitated towards certain things,
like
I don't know, Stevie Wonder.
Oh yeah,
Stevie Wonder.
Can I just say this? I say something funny. Yeah. I've had a million guests on this show over the years.
Yeah.
And whenever it's a music guest and we talk about influences, the first name that comes out of everybody's mouth, take a guess,
Stevie Wonder.
Why is that?
It was just magical. It just completely like engrossed me. I was like, he's like a magical man. I think it was just the harmonic language and the inventiveness and the production and the range of concepts and it's just something about Songs in the Key of Life. I literally was just addicted to that from the age of seven, and then like Tracy Chapman. So I think I just gravitated towards certain like bits, and that's how I kind of carved out my own sort of taste.
Yeah. It's amazing. I think about Stevie and Songs in the Key of Life, to your point, it's hard not to fall in love with that project. Stevie wrote that when he's just a year or two younger than you.
I know, it's crazy.
Isn't that amazing? He was young.
I know. He's like, wow.
And puts out an album like that, it's just it's unbelievable. Your stuff was pretty unbelievable, particularly this song you're going to play for us in a few minutes here. I've heard so many love songs over the years, but never heard a love song that is so melodic to a piano. Tell me about this song.
Well, it's a song I wrote when I was like, basically my mum was like diagnosed with cancer, and I moved out briefly to kind of make music, and when it was kind of diagnosed as terminal, I moved back in, back at home, and literally I was just sitting on the sofa. We were watching TV, and my mum was there, and the line "No one knows me like the piano" in my mother's home just kind of came to me, mm-hmm. out of like thin air kind of thing, and it was just something that stuck with me, and I just like expanded on that, and I think it's just like a note. Obviously, it's a note to my piano, but it's really a note to my mother. It's, you know, it's the most important thing is that is the piano in my mother's house, and all the kind of how formative, you know, that period of time was for me. And I could see it was something I never contemplated before, that mm-hmm. this isn't going to last forever. This is impermanent. It's something I sort of took for granted, you know, being at coming back home, being at mom's house, my mum being there, and my piano obviously was something that's, you know, has been there and sort of stayed the same since I was, you know, really young.
You and I were talking before we came on the air.
Yeah.
As black men, I think our number one goal is to make our mamas proud.
Yeah.
Everybody wants mama to be proud of them.
Yeah.
Your mom didn't live long enough to see this debut album, but she certainly saw enough of your success to know that you were going to be all right.
Yeah, no, she was definitely proud. She wasn't like a woman of many words, so she wouldn't say it out.
Yeah.
But, you know, she stopped complaining, she was smiling a lot more, you know, when she could see, like, I was, like, supporting myself from, you know, making music, and it looked like things were going to be all right. And that made me, like, so happy. I was, like, probably, like, the happiest period of my life, really, when I kind of, you know, we got on really well.
You seem most comfortable behind the scenes. I can tell you're a little shy.
Yeah.
How are you navigating, or how do you think you're going to navigate this process of being out front? Because now it's all on you now. The spotlight is on you.
Yeah.
It's not on Drake anymore. It's on you.
It's a bit of a strange thing. I mean, I guess I'm just like going with the flow a little bit and seeing how, you know, I kind of react to certain situations, and I'm just learning as I go along.
Yeah.
But I feel like I've sort of delayed this like process or this thing because I knew like in the past I wasn't quite ready for any of it, really, just as a person. Some people might be, you know, like
to be out front, you mean?
Yeah, to be out front.
Yeah.
Just because of all the things that kind of come along with that. Mm-hmm. I'm not the person. I felt like I was a little bit naive to it, like the industry, and but now I guess, you know, through the experiences I've had, I'm just more used to being able to let go of things and being able to fail a bit more and sort of explore and not be so kind of scared. So I'm just kind of seeing how things are going and, taking all this, like, stimulus in and sort of analyzing it.
I find that a lot of artists, over time, work their way into being transparent. Mm. They work their way into being authentic, into being open. But you started out that way. Your stuff is it's just out there.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it, the honest stuff really just comes out.
Yeah.
If I, you know, when I'm, like, you know, sit at the piano, as much as it may be like a bit of a, I don't know, a cliche thing or something to say that is how like cathartic it is for me, but you know, making this album, it really was a bit of an escape for me because it was, you know, I was going through a difficult time personally, and that's where, you know, I would come out with things that I didn't even know I was thinking or feeling. Just, you know, my brain sort of, you know, there's something about the flow, you know, when you're sitting there and improvising and singing, there's just stuff that kind of came out of me, really. And that's sort of like the beauty of, like, you know, sitting at the piano and writing music.
Sounds like process to me.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Process, that's the name of the album. It's his debut, and you do not want to miss picking it up and adding it to your collection. I promise you'll hear this name time and time again. Closing us out is Sam for performing the track "No One Knows Me Like the Piano."
Thank you.
For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.